O God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight. O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Following the execution and resurrection of Jesus, Peter and the apostles were teaching and performing wonders in Jerusalem. They were beginning to attract quite a following, thousands of people converting and beginning to follow after this way. The religious leaders of the day, the temple authorities, they were beginning to get uneasy and to oppose the apostles, to order them arrested. It all must have had a terrible familiarity. It must have felt a bit like deja vu, as if the cycle of Jesus' own teaching and wonders and persecution and execution, as if this was all beginning again. And it was top of mind for Peter and the disciples how that had ended. In today's passage, Peter finds himself back in front of a panel of judges again. But some things are different now. Instead of just being a part of the problem, Peter is now the whole problem. And something else was different too. The ground had shifted. The tables had turned. The huge garrison of Roman soldiers who had been there to enforce the will of the temple authorities, they were long gone. They'd gone back to Caesarea by the sea. And now the crowds that had been on the side of the authorities, now they were on Peter's side, so that the temple authorities were afraid to put one foot out of line, lest they be killed themselves. The tables had turned. I put myself in Peter's shoes here in the temple. I'm faced with people who had just weeks before executed my beloved teacher unjustly and were now threatening me, but the crowds are on my side. The threat of violence. Now that's something that's in my hands. I might have some choice words at a minimum. I might have some choice words to fling in the teeth of my enemies. And what does Peter say to them? Well, he doesn't sugarcoat it. He tells them that they are the very ones who had put God's son to death. And that Jesus is even then sitting at the right hand of God. And so with the powers of earth and heaven both on his side, Peter can say truly whatever he pleases. And Peter's message is, even now, return. Even now, return. Turn to God. Turn around. Even now, the way is open for you, for forgiveness, even the forgiveness of having put to death the Son of God. Peter could have said anything, and what he does is offer grace, saying that the forgiveness of God cannot be exhausted, it cannot be run through, even for having executed the Son of God. Turn around. Turn around. Get it more right. Look with clear eyes at what had been done and do better. Get it more right. In a moment, Peter has summed up the Christian approach to moral reform. The crucifixion and resurrection of Christ, it's set as the central supporting pillar to understand human moral relationship to God. That is, that there is nothing that I can do to place myself beyond God's redeeming love. Whatever I might do, as bad as it might be, whatever I might do, it is not going to be as difficult to forgive in the sight of God as is the unjustified murder of the Son of God. And so there is no reason for me to pretend when I am dealing with God, to confess, to seek to reform only those minor failures, and yet hold back from laying before the throne those things of which I have reason to truly be ashamed. Why hold back on those things which truly sicken me and give up only those things about which I don't really care? This is all a preacher's ramblings to capture in a page or three of words what a hymn does in a couplet. The love of God is broader than the measure of the mind, and the heart of the eternal is most wonderfully kind. This is the Sunday in the life of our congregation when we celebrate the life and legacy of 18th century poetic genius Phyllis Wheatley, the first African-American woman to be a published poet, a prodigy who corresponded with George Washington and matched wits with Ben Franklin, who met with revolutionaries from around the world, whose books were heralded with front page headlines. All of this despite being enslaved from the age of 8, and a baptized full member of this congregation of Old South Church. We celebrate and remember Phyllis Wheatley. She ought to be remembered and celebrated. It is only right that we do so. But we ought feel uncomfortable about this connection. Not because of anything Phyllis Wheatley did, but because of what we, Old South Church, did, or rather did not, do. Phyllis Wheatley died despite international fame. She died in abject poverty at the age of 33. Her life and her children's lives cut short from crushing poverty. Asthma and pneumonia worsened by terrible living conditions, and she wasn't helped by the other members of this church. Now, first, you've got to understand a little bit about Puritan New England church membership. First, you have to understand that Phyllis Wheatley didn't merely attend worship at Old South Church. She was a full member of the church, and this meant that in order to become a member, she would have to be subjected to a theological and moral examination by the elders of the church. This was well within her abilities. She read several languages. She was well educated in biblical and philosophical matters. But the point is, relatively few people who worshiped at Old South Church, relatively few of them at that time, were full members of the church. It was something of a congregation inside of the congregation. And the moral responsibility that the members had for one another was, among other things, to care for one another. As one 17th century Puritan document puts it, members of the church owed one another mutual encouragement unto all temporal comfort in all things, seeking the good of each other, out of which may be derived true peace. Another way to think of this is that if the wealth and belongings of the church are owned by anyone, they are owned by all the members of the church. And they are for the good of the people of the church to use for mutual upbuilding and for the cause of the gospel. If they belong to anyone, then they belonged to Phyllis Wheatley as much as they did any other full member of the church. But in this Old South, we failed to uphold our covenant promises to Phyllis Wheatley. The failure of this is well summarized by Sebastian Francisco de Miranda y Rodriguez. He was from Venezuela, one of the many South and Central American revolutionaries who traveled to New England at that time to meet with those in the newly formed United States who had so recently overthrown colonial rule, to meet with them, to build relationships, to perhaps seek financial support. This visiting revolutionary had met with Phyllis Wheatley a few months earlier. Then, upon learning of her death, he wrote, "These good great folks all know and perhaps admired, nay, praised, genius in bondage." And then, like the priests and Levites in sacred writ, passed by, not one good Samaritan among them. This man wrote these words about all of Puritan New England. But the force of these words fall most squarely on this church, Old South Church. We celebrate Phyllis Wheatley, and also we failed her in her hour of need. It makes me uncomfortable. It makes me want to squirm out of my shoes. That's often how it is with the truth. I return to the temple in Jerusalem, to Peter before the tribunal. where he declared they had failed, didn't sugarcoat it. And I see that I'm not the Apostle Peter in this whole affair. If I'm anybody, it's the religious leaders who are looking back on a frankly pretty imperfect moral record. And what of God's view of this imperfect moral record? What does God ask of those? Even now, return to me, says God. Return to divine ways, return to the paths of justice. Get it more right this time. This is the path of moral reform for the Christian faith. Not to pretend perfection. There's no reason to pretend when dealing with God, God who already knows the truth, to offer up for forgiveness only those minor failures yet hold back from laying before the throne those things which truly harm the conscience. Why hold back from telling the truth as if God could be deceived? Because we do not have to be afraid of the truth. We are free. Free to do better. Free to get it more right this time. From the very depths of the message of the cross, we see that there is nothing that we can do which is so deep a failure that we would be cast out of God's sight. What need is there for hiding from the truth? We are free to recognize the ways that the very forces which swept together to cut short Phyllis Wheatley's life at the age of 33, were free to see that those things are still abroad today, the ways that the control of wealth has still remained in largely the hands of white people. That's one of the reasons why we as a congregation are investors in the nation's largest black-owned bank, which is right here in Boston, One United Capital. We're free to recognize that among the senior ministers of this church memorialized on the wall, whose names are next to Nancy's, next to Jim's, that there are six who were enslavers, including one who engaged in the sale of enslaved people, put it in the newspapers and everything. And then, upon his death, willed his property to the church, which we still hold. Creates a moral duty. First, to understand the truth. And in knowing the truth, understanding the truth, know that we are free. Free to do better than we did before. Free to get it more right. We are free to see the ways that the church in this country, not just this congregation, the church in this country has been just as tied up as anyone else in the ranking of humanity based on skin. How among the many historic and important black churches in Boston, there is not one that has an endowment. That is why we have invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in black-led community revival projects through our denomination, through the Cornerstone Fund. These things aren't matters of completion. They're matters of reform. They're matters of understanding the truth, being free to do better, to get it more right, freed from any kind of shame, freed from any kind of sense of fear over what speaking the truth might mean, but instead to serve the cause of the gospel. I'm not a perfect man. I make many mistakes, many errors. We look at those who came before and we see that they were not perfect people either. Neither were they irredeemable villains. Villains and heroes, they make good fiction and poor history. We can look back upon 356 years of history with honesty and hold much to be proud of, and much that when we see the errors, the inhumanity, the failure to show compassion or treat our kin as equal, to even love one another as we ought, to even love the members of this church as deeply as we ought. We can look to those errors and say, we are going to get it more right. We are going to get it more right. Thanks be to God for that freedom. For the freedom to do as God hopes we might. Amen.